is it just intellectual knowledge?
Yeah, it could be intellectual. Direct is a big difference.
Any perception?
Yeah.
Of emptiness?
Yeah, it says a realization of emptiness.
Any realization.
Which implies that it's pretty accurate.
This is Wendy.
Hi, Wendy. We know. Okay, have a seat. We'll talk afterwards, okay? But you can absorb as much as...
So can you tell the one that correct came, please?
Yeah, I said yesterday it was... I said last time it was the direct perception of emptiness mixed with love. But now I'm saying it's just the perception of emptiness. It doesn't have to be direct. It doesn't have to be in meditation. It can be just thinking.
Intellectual.
Yeah, it can be that. Just hold it and listen. Okay. All right. Last time we talked about the three refuges. Sometimes they're called the three places of refuge, the three jewels. There's a difference between the jewels and the things themselves, like the Dharma jewel and the Dharma is not the same thing, right? I mean, this is Dharma. The books are Dharma, but they're not the Dharma jewel. Why? The Dharma jewel can only be two things.
It's a movement inside your mind.
Yeah, either a path, which is a thought, which is an attitude, or a cessation, which is the ending of some bad quality in your mental stream forever. So... Yeah, although somebody was debating me in New Jersey, pretty good debate, you know, how can you have both? How could one thing be both? It's very difficult. So anyway, one is an absence, one is a mental thought, but I'm not going to get into that. Anyway, there's a difference between the jewel and the thing itself, like the Dharma and the Dharma jewel. So we talked about the things that you go to refuge to. Now, today we're going to talk about what it is to go for refuge. What is going for refuge? You hear it a lot in, you know, every Dharma teacher who ever comes to New York for those two-day lightning visits, you know, they say, oh, take refuge, you know, and everybody goes, I take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Okay, your name is Yeshe Sundri, you know, bye. And then, okay, the taking refuge is not the words of taking refuge. There is a vow of taking refuge. That is not taking refuge. That is what we call, in name only, it's taking refuge. It's a kind of taking refuge, but it's not the taking refuge. It's not the real taking refuge. We call it nominal taking refuge. This is the real taking refuge. This is the real definition of taking refuge here. Okay, so try it. Repeat, okay?
Yu
Shenla
Rangtopki
Rangtopki
Rewa
Rewa
Chawe
Chawe
Semba
Semba
Kamdoi
Kamdoi
Senyi
Senyi.
Okay. That's the real meaning of what it is to take refuge. Okay. Now we'll explain it. Yul means an object. Alright? Yul means an object. Alright? Yul. Shen means another, something other. La means two.
T-O.
T-O. Okay.
La means two?
Yeah, T-O. Tibetan is easy. When you learn Tibetan, you'll find out that La means two, four, on, at, in, for the length of, for the duration, and then all of those are one word in Tibetan. La. Rang means itself. Dog means power. What's Dokje men? What do you guess is the elixir? What do you call it? Dokje men, the herb for generating strength. What do you think that's a translation for?
Dokje men.
Ginseng.
Vitamins. That's what Tibetans. That's their word for vitamins. So dop is what you get from vitamins. Dokje. Ki means of. I'm sorry, by. Rewa means hope. 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 There's a saying in Tibet, famous saying, Rewa gyamna myo wen chap. Once you put your hope, once you get your hopes up for something, you never get it. Rewa, hope. Chawa means to put all your hopes in something. To put all your hopes in something. And Semba means, Semba is a very difficult word to translate. It means any time the mind moves. Any movement of the mind. Any time the mind goes kick. I call it movement of the mind, but it sounds a little bit too much like bowel movements. So I think we might have to
check.
That is maybe, you know. I mean, you think about it.
Is that thought?
It's close to thought, but you see, I almost used the word thought. And in one case, I did use the word thought, and you'll see. But not all sembas are thoughts. Thought implies a mental verbalization. You know, I thought to myself, I better get out of here. But semba can be just like a moment of anger is semba. You know, any time the mind does anything, that's semba. So it doesn't have to be conceptual. So that's a hard thing to translate. Some people have made up a word called mentation, and I don't like it too much because it's not English. Okay. Kyamdo means going for refuge. Kyam means refuge, Do means going. Kyamdo.
That's a Y at the end?
Yeah, Kyamdoi. The Y makes it of. It's like apostrophe S. That Y is apostrophe S, like John's. Yeah, going for refuge is. Seni, definition. Seni means definition. Okay. You are now Senipas. Tsenipa means a monk in the monastery who isn't just doing easy things anymore. He decided to become a logician. Okay, so Tsenipas. I mean, monks who go into the deep studies, they call them, the name they call them are Tsenipas. They are now working in the realm of definitions, precision. They are, so you're into that. I hope you like it. But that's the way it's going to be. That's my training, and that's what I...
Seni is definition.
Yeah, Seni means definition. So now we'll translate, okay? You can say that thought for now, but thought... In Tibetan, you translate backwards, okay? The Tibetan order and the English order are completely backwards. That thought in which you put all your hopes in another object, and I don't know how to say it in English very well, but that thought should be of its own power. And we'll talk about that. Of its own power. It goes by on its own power. And I'll explain it. You'll never figure it out. I went and asked my lama to make sure I had it.
Sorry, that thought will be.
It has its own, it's on its own power. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that.
So you're saying that thought, which has its own power.
That thought, which has its own power, puts all its hopes into some other object. That's what it is to go to refuge.
So we can scratch out in which you put all and replace it with...
which puts
that no, this is which yeah. of its own power.
There's a nice definition in your reading at the back of the notebook. So, you know, there's a clean definition back there. I'm giving you the done.
I got tests to take and stuff, and I want to make sure I get it right.
That thought, which of its own power,
which
puts all its hopes in another object, is the definition of going for refuge.
Another object.
And in the monastery, I mean, you'd be like, sure. You should not only be very tired to someone. You would have this class in the morning, and then by evening you'd be expected to be debating for like 4 hours, and then you wouldn't forget it for your whole life.
Do they take notes, or is it?
They don't take notes. They read the book with the teacher. And then they go home and think about it. And then in the evening they have to debate it for maybe 4, 5, 6 hours. And then you never forget it. You know, if you debated it, you don't forget it easily. It's a very good system. You memorize the root text before you go to class. You might memorize the whole book. Okay, so that's what it is to go for refuge. That's what it means to go for refuge. Yul Shen La means some other person or thing outside of yourself, obviously. When you want protection, you usually go to something other than yourself. You're going to something else. The reason you go for protection is that you don't have the power. The reason you're taking protection, taking shelter, is that you're going to somebody else for help because you don't have the necessary power, or you wouldn't have to go for shelter. You could stand there and fight whatever it is yourself. That's refuge. That's the idea. Refuge means running away to something that can help you.
Well, this is going for refuge as opposed to having refuge.
Yeah, this is the definition of going for refuge. We talked about refuge already. We already talked about what you run to. We talked about mummy. Now we're talking about what is it to run to mummy? What does it mean to run to mummy? So this is going for refuge. We'll skip Rang Tokyo right now. Rewa Chawai Samba means to put all your hopes in that object. All your hopes. And that implies some kind of commitment to that object. You really believe that that object has the power to help you. Total conviction that that object can help you. And that's why you go to that. That's why you run to that object. So I think we mentioned it last time. There's two things going on when you take refuge. Kali, give me one. There's two, what they call two elements in refuge. There has to be two things present for refuge to take place.
Fear.
Why do you run to mommy?
Because you're afraid.
Yeah, you gotta be afraid. Fear is the first requirement. First requirement is fear. You're afraid of something. That's why you're running for protection. And then what, can you guess the second part? That you must have.
That object has the power to help you. The belief
that that object can help you. The reason you run to mommy and you don't run to your sister is mommy's big and mommy has authority. Mommy can do something. You know, she can do something about it. Little sister can't help you. You don't run to little sister, you run to mommy. So there's two things going on when you take refuge. The first is included here. When I say Yul Shen La, some other object, it means someone outside of myself. I'm afraid. When I say Rewa Chawai Samba, I believe that object has some power to help me. There has to be two things going on when you take refuge.
And that's not what we're talking about here.
Tell me.
So we talked. You lost me. The difference between the object of refuge and going for refuge. So I'm
mommy and going to mommy. Tonight we're only talking about going to mommy.
So it's
last week we talked about mommy.
The noun and the verb. Yeah.
Right. Taking refuge.
Okay.
Going for protection. There are two. That's why this week we split the class into two parts. The first class was all about Buddha Dhamma Sangha jewels. What is the object of refuge? They call it object of refuge, or place that you go for protection. We finished that. Now, what is it for you to go there? You know, what do you have to have in your mind to go there? When they say have refuge, it means you have this state of mind. And that is that state of mind. That's what refuge is. It's not the words of
have refuge, the verb, or have refuge, the noun?
When you say have refuge, what you mean is taking refuge. People say, do you have refuge? They say, are you taking refuge? Which means, are you running to mommy? Okay. Yeah. It's that. Refuge is there. The refuges are there. Buddha is there. Dharma is there. Sangha is there. They're like there's a joke in Tibet, in the Lamrim. They're like a big, what do you call that out in a picnic ground where there's a big, no walls, just a roof.
Yeah.
What do you call it?
Pavilion.
Yeah, pavilion. Yeah. So you're standing, there's a pouring rain, and the pavilion is over there, and you stand in the rain and you go, pavilion, 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 pavilion. You know? So that's like most people, most Buddhists are like that, you know. You know, and then walking under the pavilion, out of the rain, is going for refuge. That's the mind. That's the state of mind. It's not the you have to say that, but you have to have the thought going on at the same time. So what does it mean? By the way, this is not the definition of Buddhist refuge, going for refuge to a Buddhist refuge. This is just the general definition of going for refuge. Yeah. And that can be divided into two kinds. One is going to refuge to normal things, and the other is going to refuge to ultimate things. So, people in the world, we all day, go to refuge to... We take refuge all day in normal things.
Yeah,
right, that's the problem. Everybody takes refuge all the time.
Yeah, no, and so this...
The object that you're taking refuge to...
This is not the... this is not the goal. This is the definition of taking refuge. It's not the definition of taking Buddhist refuge.
Taking actual refuge.
This is just any refuge. This is what it is. We take refuge all day. You take refuge... Anything you think you that can help you, you are taking refuge in. All day long, I think it's important to understand, all day long you are taking refuge. The reason you get out of bed is that you want to go to work because you think money is a refuge. And it is, in a sense. It pays your rent, it feeds you. That's refuge. That is a refuge. And if you didn't have Rewa Chawai Semba, if you didn't believe it could help you, you wouldn't get up and go to work, because it's not fun, right? Most times.
Okay? It's funny, though.
That's why they pay you. Because they have to get you to come. That's Rewa Chawai Semba. That's, you have that. Or you take refuge in, say, a coat. You have a coat. You take refuge in your house. You take refuge in your friends. Your wife or your friend. Or your children. Or your career. Or even your own self. Your opinion of these are all refuges.
Well, you take refuge by not taking refuge in Dharma, which is what a lot of people do.
No,
they believe that if you take refuge in Dharma, you're going to get yourself in trouble. You know?
Yeah. And all of those objects that I talked about, all of them, all of the reason that you get up in the morning, and all of the reason that you walk around the street, and all the reason why you go to work, all the reason why you meet your friends, all the reason why you do anything is worldly refuge. You're taking refuge. Every action you do has some motivation to get something, or you wouldn't do it.
Presumably, everything you're doing is going away from suffering and toward something good.
Right,
at least that's what you think.
Every object that you put your hopes in is temporary. It can't help you. It will not help you. And we just live like fools. Our whole day is like foolish. None of the things that we work for can help us. None of the things we get up out of bed for can help us. If you get money by going to work, it's not because you got up out of bed to get the money. It's from what?
Past karma!
No, you gain money. You gain money. We have a whole wrong idea of why things are happening. That's one kind of ignorance. It's not the ultimate ignorance, but it's a pretty heavy, it's a very thick ignorance that we have. Everything we do is mistaken. You know, we think that through effort or getting waking up and doing blah blah blah, we're going to get money. But some people do and some people don't, so it's not a cause.
So if we stayed in bed tomorrow morning, we get the money anyway.
You would. You could, if you were virtuous. Yeah. Some people just goof off and the money pours down. You can see it in the world. Some people work... I mean, go to Asia and watch people work in the rice fields. And they're working much harder than any of us. And they're starving. There's no relation.
But those could be like national karmas or larger karmas,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what they are.
So it's not related to how hard you work. It's not related to how intelligent you are.
We just
there's intelligent people
here.
Who are poor. There's stupid people who are rich. It's not a cause. It's not a cause. I always say people got on an airplane and the stewardess said... Your seat number is 12B. By the way, we don't really understand why this plane runs, and it might fall down. Don't mind, just sit down. It works some of the time. Some of the time it falls down. Will you get on? but your whole life is like that. You believe that going to work will get you money, but sometimes it doesn't. So that's not the cause of you getting money. That's not what caused the money. It's crazy. It's ignorant. Okay.
It's very funny.
So that's going for refuge. Yeah, tomorrow I'll stay home. I'm going to. Michael.
You said first
time
refuge is worldly refuge, and what was this?
They call it exceptional refuge. Special refuge.
That's Buddhist refuge.
And that's Buddhist. That's where you go to a real refuge. What do you go for refuge to?
There's not three choices.
They call it exceptional refuge. We got to be careful with our words because ultimate has a different meaning, direct has a different meaning. Yeah. Yeah,
so that's just Buddhist refuge.
We can call it exceptional refuge.
Because
exceptional refuge is always Buddhist refuge.
Yeah, what they call special refuge or exceptional refuge.
And it's going for refuge in
those three
jewels.
Is the other one ordinary refuge that we were just talking about?
Yeah, yeah. All of those are ordinary refuges. When you read the Tibetan text, they'll say, going to refuge to worldly spirits, which exist, and you can propitiate them, and you can appease them, and you can get a little, sometimes they'll help you. And that was the example in Tibet. And also, but this definition fits all of our daily activities. So basically that. Okay, that's what the definition of going for refuge. If you supply the words, basically if you plug in the words three jewels, then you have the definition of Buddhist refuge. Yeah, exceptional refuge. And we don't do that. All right, now.
Kedu,
Chung,
Chung,
Ding,
Ding,
Chenpo,
Chenpo,
Sung,
Kedu,
Chung,
Chung,
Ding,
Ding,
Chenpo,
Sung, Sung.
Kedu means person. Okay, person. In Buddhism, that can mean an animal also, but not in this case.
Can it mean anything else, like a hell being, or a...
Yeah, oh yeah.
Being.
Any being.
Sentient being?
You can say being. But there's another word for being, but anyway. What I'm trying to say is that person is, in Buddhism, not limited to a human. A dog is a person, too. Long story. Chung means small. In Tibetan, how they say small, do you know? Chung-chung. Ding, you had last class. It was one of the three kinds of sutras. Do you remember?
The middle.
The middle one, okay. Ding means middle. Medium. Chenpo, you know.
Three.
Chenpo means big. Su means three. These are three levels of practitioner. They're very famous. They're in the long room. And they are, we're going to talk about five different kinds of refuge, five different kinds of going for refuge. And these are the first three. Kebu Chung means a little person, medium person, and a big person. You can call it, if you're writing a book, you call it practitioner of advanced sculpt. And, you know, think of it as little person, it's all right now. Little person means the person with the minimum motivation for a Buddhist. He has the minimum thought you can have and still be a Buddhist. He has the smallest, lowest motivation that a Buddhist can have. And that's that he wants to get out of the three lower births. He does not want to go to the three lower births. Okay, what are they?
Hell.
Animal.
Hungry.
And what we call preta or hungry ghosts. Okay. Buddhism is not stupid. Buddhism doesn't say you can see these two. Buddhism says you can't see these two right now if you're just a normal person. I cannot prove to you that these two exist. Okay, and the books say that over and over again. They do exist. The Buddha said they exist. You can see them in certain states of meditation. But I can't prove it to you, and I can't show it to you right now. So take it as the word of the Buddha and doubt it, okay. But at least you can see animals. Okay. So animals, hungry ghosts, which are spirits that we can't see. They live around us. We can't see them. They have bodies. They're very subtle bodies. We can't see those bodies. Probably what Western people say they've seen ghosts or spirits, probably they saw something like that. And then hell being, which you can read about in the Western religions also. The descriptions of hell in the Abhidhamma Kosha, and the descriptions of hell by Dante or the Christian writers are exactly the same. So it's pretty interesting. You know, I would tend to think that people in each religion had seen them directly and described them. You know, some people struggle to say that the Greeks met the Kashmiris and somehow this myth covered, or they say, oh, hell is just a metaphor. That's very wrong, by the way. It's not just a metaphor, it exists.
A lot of Buddhists believe that.
Very wrong. Very
much. Tibetan monks, I don't believe.
They they'll have a direct experience. No, it exists. I haven't. Well,
you
I mean,
said they did. They believed in it until they went to the monastery, and it was after years of studying at the monastery that they began to disbelieve.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
I'm just repeating.
No, the great text Nagarjuna outlines hell in his Sarveka in 200 A.D. The Buddha describes hell in detail in his Jataka tales. The Abhidharma, the third chapter, spends many pages on hell, and it exists. It does exist. And you know it exists because you know about emptiness, and you know the four principles of karma. You can imagine that it exists. If those four principles of karma are true, then a perception of yourself hurting someone now could cause you to have a perception much greater, you know, much more intense, and much longer. I mean, the hell's, according to the scriptures, the life of a being in hell is very, very long, extremely long.
Are hell beings, I realized I didn't know this today when I was writing out the answers to that, one of the questions on the heart. Animals have mothers and are born in a particular way, and so do our humans. Do hell beings, are they born in the same way?
Abhidharma, third chapter, explains four kinds of birth. There are four ways of taking birth. And one is called Zutikila, which means you just appear in that place. Like Padmasambhava was Zutikila. That's why he's called Padmasambhava, because he was born from a lotus. Some saints are born from a lotus. So
the lotus born.
The hell is in hell you just appear there, and your body has special qualities. You know, they can torture you and kill you, and then you'll revive again, and then they torture you and kill you again, and then you revive again.
You don't need a mother.
No. No, in hell they don't have it. Hell beings are Zutikila.
You have someone to torture instead.
No, it exists, and it's not funny. If you ever get a glimpse of it, it's terrible. It's horrible. It's like just fire, and much more painful than this fire on earth. They say much more painful than this.
Can I say something?
Yeah. There's a long description about that. What lights you see and things like that. It's a very long description, good description. And in fact, when you reach the higher levels of practice, you need to know about that because you need to use it. Okay, Gebu Chung. So these people, the lowest Buddhist motivation is to get yourself out of those three births.
This is like a small scope.
Yeah, small scope. I like that word, by the way. And that's what's in the text, smaller scope.
Can you say by extension also that, you know, not just to always be reborn as a human, but at least, but, you know, a decent birth as well?
No.
They don't care. So long as I'm in the human realm.
No, not even human. They can be in higher than human also. But they do not want to go to one of those three lower births. They will do, they are living this life. Their life in this world is dedicated not to being born there.
What makes you
born and
Anything. Bad deeds. Ten bad deeds, basically. Check the calendar.
Okay.
I mean, those are 84,000 deeds. Yeah, if you want. Thank you.
So, it's about the first life?
Morality. Do these and you don't go. Do them, don't do them and you go.
Well, these things
do not have wrong sex.
Foe destroyer, is that what this is?
No. No. This is just any person who's...
What's wrong sex, Michael?
There's lots of them. There's two pages of wrong sex.
Question better would be, what's right sex?
Shorter page.
You can check the calendar.
Huh?
This is the text of the calendar without the calendar.
It doesn't say, Michael.
No, just... Well, you can... Take out all the ones there and whatever's left is okay.
Thank you.
I mean, everybody lies. Is everybody going to go to hell?
According to scriptures, 99.999% of all people will go to hell.
Wow.
That's being awfully
funny. Not funny.
Michael, it's Western Dharma. I mean, it's the best people
out
here. I mean,
there's good intentions to help, yes. I mean, for example, there are non-Buddhists who commit suicide after doing some kind of special prayer in India, in ancient India. And they thought that was... It's actually a great bad deed. But they thought it was nirvana. They thought it was how to get to nirvana. So actually, from the point of view of motivation, that was a virtue. So yeah, if your heart is in the right place, it's a long way to, you know, not taking it. We'll talk about it. So that's the motivation of the smallest level of practitioner. I went to a lecture in Arizona. The Dalai Lama spoke during the day, and some other people spoke at night. And after I came out, something bothered me. You know, something bothered me about the lecture, and I thought about it for a long time, and I thought, this is not a Buddhist lecture. They didn't mention next life at all. They're talking about how to be happy, well-balanced, you know, friendly, you know, just how to be kind of cheery in this life. And it just occurred to me, that's nice, but it's not Buddhism. You know, the minimum practice, the minimum reason to go for refuge is concern about what's going to happen when you die. That's a minimum. Okay? If you don't have that, you're not a Buddhist.
So, not Mahayana, all Buddhism.
No, any Buddhist. That is the minimum attitude to be called a Buddhist. And that's why there's this joke in Tibetan, or there's this supposedly true story that there was an abbot of a major monastery up on the throne, and some humble monk had, you know, he had the power to read his mind, and he said, you know, that abbot's not a Buddhist. He's not motivated by this minimum motivation. Yeah,
then that's the minimum goal, and the minimum motivation is fear, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
I mean, the minimum goal is to not be born in the lower realms.
Right.
The motivation for the minimum goal is fear of being born
right.
in the lower realms.
And to do the right things in this life after death. And you're young, you don't think that's such a relevant goal. You'd rather have something to work on that's going to make you happy or satisfied, or even contemplative in this life. It's not the goal. You will get everything you wanted in this life as soon as you get that. The deeds that you have to do to keep yourself out of hell are exactly what's going to make you very happy in this life. That's a side effect. They say that's like weeds when you plant hay. You know? I mean, the scriptures say that. You can get it. You can be happy in this life. You will get it. But the motivation has to be that I am working, that I do not go down when I die. And that assumes a lot. That assumes a lot. You know, that assumes that you understand how the mind streams. And that assumes that you even think there's a hell. And we don't truly have that. But as you get older, you develop it. So don't worry. Religious people get... the older people get, the more they start to worry about what will happen after they die.
Yeah, because when you're young, you feel strong and you feel nothing. Like
your mind is on the next 10 years at the most, probably the next 2 months at normally. But
I don't think it's just when you get older. I think also when you're sick and really sick and you lose your physical power. Yeah. And
they call that in ancient person. They call it goosebump renunciation. It lasts about a week after you get better. No, it's great. It's a great effort. It's very difficult to take refuge. It assumes a lot of knowledge. It assumes a lot of thinking. It assumes a lot of observation of death in other people, older people, and the people around you. It's not easy. It's very difficult. It's not like taking refuge is easy and bodhicitta is difficult. Taking refuge is very difficult. Really, really becoming a Buddhist is almost impossible. You know, they say, for example, in the monk's vows. I shouldn't say almost impossible. Very
discouraging.
No, they say that we just studied. I just did Vinaya for a month. The monks, you know, that's one of our last subjects. And we reach this part where they say that if a monk takes his vows for any other purpose than renunciation, they don't even stick.
You mean stick?
They don't take form in him. He doesn't get the vows. I mean, he can go around his whole life with the robes on, but he never got the vows.
They're not affecting his consciousness and his
karma. They never grew in his mental sphere.
So he doesn't get any of the benefits of the vows.
So then there's this long debate about, well, where are we going to find five monks to make new monks? Because it takes five monks to make a new monk. So where are we going to find five monks
Why
in the monastery?
Why does it take 5 months to make new monks?
It's the,
you have to give your vows.
The ceremony has to be administered by five monks. Which is why there's no nun's vow right now, because it dropped under five. And then there wasn't enough to get a new nun's vow.
Well, there may be a nun's vow. We're checking. Being researched.
It's being researched. Mm-hmm. And in the Tibetan tradition at present.
But why do you have to have five? Why do you have to have five?
Long story. There's 10 ways of taking a vow.
It's
not
a rule. It's
just no, it's just
refuge for practitioners in Moscow.
Yeah.
The fear of hell.
And the rest other two, yeah.
The fear of falling to the lower realm. I would say that, in a somewhat altered form, motivates a lot of people with a lot of different religious backgrounds, perhaps more in previous generations than it does
now. Oh, yeah. They were, in that sense, they were ahead of us.
That was very strong, but I wouldn't say that it required a tremendous amount of knowledge. It was almost a superstitious, impulsive...
Yeah, well, that wouldn't be very firm. It wouldn't be very strong.
Oh, I think it was very strong indeed, but it wasn't an intellectual
thing. Well,
maybe. It was an emotional thing.
I'd say that would be... We call that the Duljat Dulpo, for thick-headed disciples. And better is those who study and understand why hell is very possible. No, just based on what we can see here, knowing the principles of how your mind works, studying the functions of the mind, hell becomes extremely plausible.
Isn't it hell also in this world?
No.
One can be in hell in
no,
this world?
No, much worse. It's a bad idea. You know, some Buddhist teachers in the West have said, oh, hell is just a metaphor for depression or something. No, not correct.
Well, should we think about
it? There is a place how...
Yeah, it is
being
depressed. It's like a real super-duper depressed. Hot one, yeah.
Okay. Bing, what is the motivation of the middle person, the medium person?
To get out of sequence existence.
Yeah, he wants to get out of this form of life altogether. He understands that it doesn't even matter if you're born in one of the higher realms, like a human realm. It's still suffering. He understands that even this life that we are living, which is the best in the dirty world, in the samsara, in the suffering world, is pain. And that nothing about this life is very nice. None of the comforts you have now will last, period. None of the things you take comfort in, none of the things you work for, none of the things about your health or your looks or your friends or your house or your parents or your family or your children, or none of them will last, period. They'll all go. It's just suffering. It's a temporary state. I translated... Did I tell you that? For Yeshe Denin.
Did you?
Many years ago, 20 years ago. That's how these classes started. Oh. And he said... health is an accident.
Right.
He said the four elements are... The four elements are going like this, and then sometimes, you know, the four balls are up in the air all spinning right. But the normal condition is illness. You know, the standard condition of a human being is illness.
So the suffering is actually permanent?
No. It can be stopped.
Okay.
But we don't have anything except suffering. The things we believe are comfort... Are actually another kind of suffering. The most obvious fact about those comforts is that you lose them. And if you don't think so, wait. You know, everything about your appearance, everything about your health, everything about your work, everything about your intelligence, you will lose it.
How can it be stopped?
That's why we're having class. No, really? No kidding.
Well, as long as we're in this life, we're going to be in samsara anyway.
Not true. Not true.
We'll go to the Pustalesha.
So can we say here that the goal for
By the way, that's the big time. We're going for the big time. I'm not teaching this class that you go home feeling better, or you're a better adjusted person, or, you know, you're more
like
friendly,
you're
we're going for the big time. The purpose of this class is that you don't undergo a normal death. And that you no longer have any kind of suffering. That's the minimum of purpose of this class. It's not that somehow your work goes a little nicer. Or, you know, no.
It's not working.
Because still you got to get old and die. I met this great Korean Japanese master. They said, this is Jo Gwang-gu, you know, and he was able to sit out in the snow for 3 days. And I look at and I'm waiting. I bought a flower and I waited at the airport for it. And And he came off the airplane, and he's like, you know, and he was he died the next year. He was very old, and he was suffering.
Frozen.
No, he was suffering badly, and I said, I thought to myself, well, what does it matter? He sat out in the snow for 3 days. If he's got old, you know, I'm not interested in that.
But it's an achievement. Well, whether you call it the ultimate, it is still an achievement.
Who cares if you die? Who cares if you put your body out in the snow if your body gets old and wrinkled and dies?
I understand.
Anyway.
It was something that was supposed to happen in his mind as a result of that.
One nice short sentence about
that. The middle person, his motivation is to get out of all forms of suffering life.
It's renunciation for cyclic existence.
Yeah, it's what we studied in the first
course. It's the motivation, and the goal is nirvana, right?
Well, at minimum, he wants to get out of. He can go shoot for Buddhahood too. That's okay.
No, the middle. The satisfaction is the renunciation of cyclic existence doesn't necessarily
have to be a Buddha. No. Okay. Chembo, what's the big person after?
Can I ask a question about this?
Yeah.
About the middle, I get somewhat confused because the idea of, you know, you've got the, you don't have Mahayana motivation and yet you can escape samsara. I thought you can only escape samsara as a Buddha.
I used to worry about that myself. I used to worry about it a lot. I used to think, how can you get the virtue to perceive emptiness, which is necessary to get nirvana, if you don't love people?
Yeah.
You know, doesn't that virtue imply loving people? They have compassion in the Hinayana scriptures. The Abhidharma teaches compassion. It's not the compassion as it's taught in the, but it is certainly they have love. They have loving kindness, they have compassion.
Even beyond that, though, I was thinking, I thought only attaining Buddhahood really gets you out of samsara, not arhat or whatever.
No, arhat is the end of samsara.
It is, even though you're not a Buddha.
Right.
And to be fair, this is a Mahayana description here. Presumably a Hinayana would only have the first two persons.
It's a big debate.
Well, presumably.
Big debate. It is a big debate. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's not like they don't accept it automatically. Chembo. Chembo means great. Okay. What is the motivation of the third person? What do you guess, Fran?
To get out of cyclic existence for the benefit of all sentient.
And take everybody else with him. Okay. He doesn't want anyone else to suffer. It goes beyond the three lower realms for himself. It goes beyond the three upper realms for himself. It goes out to all realms, all beings. He wants all beings to get out of all suffering. That's why he's going for refuge.
Very fine point. Does he want to
get
leave cycling existence also for some?
Nice, beautiful. I love it. That was the next thing. Nice.
Okay.
That was the next point. She said, what she's basically saying is that, does Chembo also have the motivation of Chungun Ding? Is he interested in getting his own rear end out of the lower three births? Is he interested in getting himself out of all six kinds of birth? On top of wanting everyone else out? Yes. And that's why we call, and you'll see it in your text, the motivation which is shared with lower people. A person who's reached the highest motivation still has, obviously he still has those lower motivations. The Buddha still has those motivations. The Buddha has no interest in taking birth into hell. Okay? I mean, Buddha Shakyamuni has no, you know, desire to see himself take birth into hell. He still has that motivation.
Isn't it true, in fact, that you can't have the great motivation without the lower
two? Yeah, really, it's true. Why?
Because
you can't have the second of the three paths.
Yeah, because it's that same feeling turned outward.
Right.
If you don't have the feeling for yourself, you can't have it for others. Yeah.
From the first. Okay. So those are the first three kinds of going for refuge. There's the going for refuge which we share with smaller motivation people. There's the going for refuge that we share with people of middle motivation. And then there's the going for refuge that the people of large scope have. We'll do two more kinds after the break. By the way, it's okay. We'll come back in about 10 minutes. It's a good place to stop. Anila made some soup, if anybody wants some soup.
Wow.
There's two kinds.
I can't tell you much about it.
Gyui? Say Gyui.
Gyui.
Gyamdo.
Gyamdo.
Not Gui, okay?
Gyui.
Gyamdo. Gyui, Gyamdo. Okay, this is very interesting. These are how many chemicals we have so far? How many kinds of going for refuge? We have three so far. Okay, there's two more.
Cause.
Okay. Yeah.
Cause and result.
Yeah, this is cause refuge. Okay, cause going for refuge. You have to correct me, like Tom did. I shouldn't say refuge. I should say going for refuge. Cause going for refuge. I always get these two confused, and we'll talk about it, and maybe I'll remember later. Okay. This is to take refuge in some quality which has already been achieved in another person. Like when I go to refuge to Buddha, Shakyamuni, that's Gyuhi Kempo. And this is Debri Kemdo, means result refuge, result going for refuge. And that's where I am taking refuge. This is I like this refuge. In future Michael the Buddha. I'm taking refuge in my future Buddha.
So how is that different than the Buddha jewel? Going for refuge
result
in the Buddha jewel?
Oh, is... Yeah, these are all forms of exceptional refuge. These five, by the way, I didn't mention that. These are the five divisions of exceptional going for refuge. These are the five divisions of Buddhist refuge going for refuge.
Five divisions of what?
Of a Buddhist going for refuge. These are all going for refuge to the three jewels. So in result refuge, I'm going for shelter in my own future Buddhahood, and my own future Dharma, and my own future Sangha. If I'm not that already.
You did say that.
And the other one?
The other one is to go for refuge to a person other than myself, who already has those things in his mind. He already has the three jewels. He already is the three jewels.
Isn't that the Lama?
Could be he's a Dharma jewel.
To a rat.
He has... I could go to the knowledge in the mind of a person who's perceived emptiness. If I go to a refuge
in the Sangha,
in a person who's perceived emptiness, if I go to refuge in his ideas, that's cause refuge. Result refuge is for me to go to refuge in myself, my future self.
So that could even be a subset of the other three, really.
This is the raw material of great debate. You know? Yeah. I mean, in the monastery, then you try to figure out the combinations between those five. You know, are they? Do they exclude each other or not? You know, it'd be very interesting. I think these two are exclusive.
But what are when they say the three refuges in one and the Lama? That's the Lama.
Yeah. Kemne Kundun Lama Dhammacha. Yes. Yeah. No, he has all three. The Buddha has all three. Can you have only one of them? He is all three jewels. Well, his being includes all three jewels. But then you'd have a good debate in the monastery if you said, well, is there anybody who just has one of the jewels? Just one of the jewels.
Who has achieved the resultant one and still is working on the causal other two? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, no, I mean...
Like a Sangha?
Like he is the Dharma jewel, but he's not yet the Sangha jewel. He has the Buddha jewel, but he doesn't have the Dharma.
Well, you could be certainly a Sangha jewel before you're a Buddha jewel. In fact,
that's easy. That's the easiest one. You can perceive emptiness directly and be Sangha jewel, but you haven't reached omniscience yet.
I'm a little confused about when you gave the definition of Sangha jewel. You said any person that directly perceived emptiness. Yet in the text you gave us, it said any enlightened being who possesses any one of the eight fine qualities of knowledge or liberation.
Right. Good. Good question. Sorry. I know what your problem is. It's the word realized. I use the word realized.
Well,
you have
She's
to be.
The one who translated the text.
She got stuck on the word realized, which is the word which is distinguished from enlightened. Okay, realized doesn't mean enlightened. You can be realized and not be enlightened. Realized means you realized emptiness directly. Enlightened means you know all things, and those are different. That's a distinction that you have to be careful about.
Say realized as opposed to fully realized.
That's a, that you can say that. That's a good way to think of it.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. The way I use the word, realized means a person who has realized emptiness directly.
And
enlightened means a person who knows all things. And that comes much later. You become realized first if you perceive emptiness directly. Then you become enlightened later.
I'm so confused because it seems like they're two separate definitions.
Show me.
Okay, it says in the text, the Sangha Jewel is, I quote, a realized being who possesses any number of the 8-point qualities of knowledge and liberation. But you said in the notes, the Sangha Jewel is any person who has directly perceived emptiness.
Yeah, the first three words of that definition, a realized being,
uh-huh.
That covers it, anyone who's perceived emptiness directly.
Oh,
you could say any realized being, actually.
To be realized, you have to...
Well, you'd have at least one of the five qualities if you were
right.
So.
Right. Yeah. We didn't go over the five qualities. We will. I mean, I'll do them. Oicha asked me to do that.
The five qualities.
Okay, so
eight. I
have
trouble.
So to be the Sangha Jewel, you have the minute.
The last paragraph in English.
I have page 3.
Page 3. Sorry. Okay. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, you can keep it.
Okay. I'll just go over the eight qualities of a Buddha really quickly. And these are taken from a book called Uttara Tantra, which is not a tantric one. It's just Tantra in that book means has a different meaning. You don't need to know all this, okay? It's also by Maitreya, dictated to a Sangha. And in that book, they give the qualities of the Buddha jewel. And they give eight qualities of the jewel, of the Buddha jewel. The first one here is, he is uncaused. Is the Buddha uncaused?
Really?
If he's uncaused, we're in trouble because we're trying to collect the causes to become a Buddha. Obviously, he's caused.
So
right? Aren't we trying to get together all the causes?
I was wondering about that.
Right. uncaused means this. He is... It's a little bit technical. His Dharma body, his Dharmakaya, is uncaused. What is his Dharmakaya?
It's the truth. You can't really cause
it. It is the emptiness of his mental, of his consciousness. It's the emptiness of his omniscience.
Oh, I understand.
That is the Dharmakaya. The one part of the Buddha's being is emptiness. His emptiness. You now have the emptiness. The emptiness of your mental stream is the same emptiness that you will have when you become a Buddha, and that is your Buddha nature.
Yeah, and the same then can be said of all beings.
No, all beings have the Buddha nature, not because they have something inside that, when uncovered, makes them a Buddha, and, you know, meditate tonight and see it, and you're really a Buddha already, and don't worry, and... Of course we're not a Buddha already. I'm getting old, my bones are starting to hurt, my teeth are falling out, you know, I'd rather not find something inside, you know.
So in this sense, all beings are uncaused. You could say the same of any
right,
being.
Right, technically.
Not just the Buddha.
Technically. But
so that, that
so
is
all of
common
this is
to
talking
everyone.
About, yeah. About, I mean, when you talk about emptiness.
Yeah, emptiness
then, and then when you talk about emptiness, then you then there is no Buddha even. I mean, there is even no...
Well, his Dharmakaya is his emptiness. That emptiness, the emptiness of your mind now, the emptiness of Laura Siegel's mind, will be the emptiness, will become the emptiness of Laura Siegel, the Buddha. And in that sense, you, some part of you now will be part of Laura Siegel, Buddha. And that's your Buddha nature. And that's difficult. People have, you know, there are millions of wrong explanations of Buddha nature. You can, we'll study it. We'll get there. It's in this text.
Okay. Okay.
Did you have a question, Carolyn?
No.
Okay.
Spontaneous.
Okay. He is spontaneous. Spontaneous means this. This is the, never forget the example of the moon shining at night over the United States. You know, beautiful full moon, no clouds. And every piece of water in the United States that's exposed to the sky will reflect the moon. The moon will jump into every little piece of water or ocean or lake or spring or anything where there's still water, facing the moon, he will appear there. Even your eye, in the water in your eye. You know, I mean, you look up and someone looks at your eye and they'll see the moon in your eye. That's a beautiful idea. The water represents any sentient being who's ready to meet the Buddha. And the moon represents the Buddha. The minute you are ready, the minute you are ripe, he will come to you. And he doesn't have to think. He doesn't say, oh, 4 o'clock, John Stillwell, finally, he got renunciation this afternoon, you know. I better go down and teach him, you know. He just appears. It's part of his incredible virtue from his past lives that he will appear in whatever form is useful for you at the exact moment that you're ready for it. And that's one of his qualities. It's a wonderful quality. And that can be the guy on the bus who spits on you. You know, that can be the tree that you run into. He has the power to manifest as that. And he doesn't think about it. He just is it. That's a wonderful idea.
So he will appear again, whenever?
He'll appear to you throughout the day in any form that you are ready for. That any form that will help you go a little bit further. And maybe it will be someone who attacks you or yells at you. Sound familiar?
Not going to be a nicey-nicey Buddha.
She got a fight with her boss today. Okay.
Huh? So it's not going to be a nicey-nicey Buddha.
It doesn't have to be, but it could be. It could be a beautiful angel, you know. Yeah. That's possible.
So even fighting could be a...
Very possible.
What about karma? Isn't that karma? I mean, how do you distinguish when it's caused by the karma or your karma?
Well, of course it's caused by karma. Huh? The Buddha can't appear to you if you don't have the karma to have it happen.
So it's not like it's caused by the Buddha, it's just the Buddha is there because this is happening to you.
Yeah, because the water is ready. The water is still, and the clouds are gone.
What a dream?
Could be. On one level, the reality in a dream is equal to the reality in waking. Normally it's not. Normally it's an example for unreality in movement. But he could appear to you.
Like a lucid dream.
Yeah, it has happened. It's in scripture, it's happened. It happened to a kingdom of Udayana, from God.
Yeah, but how can he appear? What do you mean when he appears to you when somebody's angry at you?
No, if it will help you go a little bit further in your practice of Buddhism, it's possible that the Buddha will, out of compassion, come and seem to be your boss and yell at you. It's very possible that emanation has been on this planet for 30 or 40 years, waiting for that moment to help you. Because what's that to a Buddha? You know, I mean, there could be someone you know from childhood.
So you're telling me my boss has an emanation of the Buddha?
Could be. Could well be.
That's a good way to think
of it. I have a hard time seeing Buddha in her.
No, it could well be if it helps you go further. If it helps you advance your practice, it could very well be. It could be.
So I guess this is referring, obviously, from the Buddhist side of this thing that you're talking about, it's effortless. And
it's a reflex.
It's right.
It's a reflex.
And that's what the spontaneousness is.
Yeah, that's what spontaneous means.
Now, from the side of the person who the Buddha is appearing to, right, obviously you have to... That's also a long process that finally gets that person to the point where they can partake of, and maybe even ignorantly, of this spontaneous largesse of all Buddhas, right? So, it sounds like that once you reach that point, then you've made some sort of a breakthrough. I guess it's possible to fall back from that point, or once you get to a certain point, there would be no reason for the Buddha to stop appearing to you. So
there's
it would be
book,
from then on, the Buddha would be appearing to
why
you all the time.
Why doesn't he appear the way he is? This way we recognize
No, what if...
Isn't
what
it
if
easier?
What if he walked... What if the Buddha walked down the street looking like the Buddha did? You would think he was crazy?
No, I wouldn't. Believe me.
By the way, if you wouldn't think that, he would appear to you that way. So the fact that he hasn't appeared to you that way means that you would think that.
So what we have to do right now is to think, okay, you know, we're serious and we're
seriously
ready and appear to us in very obvious form and...
Michael, as the Buddha appeared to you...
Okay, wait, we gotta finish.
Can we, let's...
He is realized by no other way. This means that... It's explained that you cannot perceive the Buddha through conceptual means. Okay? You can't perceive the Buddha by normal kinds of perception.
Sensory perception?
Is that true? No, not technically. If you lived in India 500 BC, he would have appeared to your senses. This refers to the perception of his Dharmakaya. You cannot see the emptiness of the Buddha without a conceptual thought, without some kind of special realization.
So you, 500 years ago, you would have seen his Dharmakaya?
His Nirmanakaya. His movie body.
His actual body?
It's not his, well, there's a debate. I mean, he's got four bodies. Who knows which is the real one? But that's the movie body. That's the one he just shows, you know?
The hologram.
You could say hologram is pretty good. He just pretended to show it. He's not like that. That's not his real form.
Almost like an invisible body, almost.
No, it's a visible one that you can see. If he doesn't show that body, you can't see him, because his real body is up in paradise, and you don't have the goodness to see it. So Buddhas, out of compassion, try to show themselves as a normal human being. It's very similar to the idea of Jesus Christ. Okay, the next three are very important, and they come together, and that's why they're all blocked out that way. He has knowledge, love, and power. There's a very famous debate about the Buddha. Knowledge here means he's aware that we are suffering. He's aware of our condition. So it doesn't help if someone's aware of your condition if they don't care anything about your suffering. So then love comes. Okay, that's the way the debate goes. You know, okay, he knows I'm in trouble, but if he said, I'm busy today, let them suffer, you know. So he has love. But it's also no good that if a person had knowledge that you're suffering, and if he cared about it, if he couldn't do anything about it, and that's power. He does have the power to do something about it. So he has those three qualities. He has the power to know perfectly you're suffering. He has the power, I mean, he cares about it. He's concerned. And then finally, he has the ability to do something about it. What can he do? The first Dalai Lama in his text on the Abhidhamma Kosha, in the opening pages, it's very beautiful. And there's a very famous quotation, and he says, look, the Buddha can't come to you and sprinkle holy water on your head and take your suffering away. And he can't transfer his knowledge to you, you know, with some kind of meditation, and then suddenly you understand what he understands. He has to talk. He has to communicate to you. It's the only way. It's the only normal way. I mean, in extraordinary cases.
But those extraordinary cases would be the result of a lot of talking. That
right, right. Yeah, that's so I mean, back to the Buddha has to appear to you as a human being, normally.
Teach you.
And he has to teach you. And that's his nupa. That's his power. That is the extent of his power.
Nupa.
He has the power to teach you.
But, so then it would be like, for example, you could be our Buddha.
There's a long debate about it.
And maybe you are.
There's a long
and you don't tell us.
I'm not. Maybe you all are.
Maybe he's just
doing
wrong.
Okay.
This is my last question.
Who the hell are you?
There was a debate.
I'm going to hang out in New York. Hey, you know?
There's a famous debate my teacher told me in the debate that happened like 40 years ago in Harvard. The Buddha's not supposed to have any wars, you know? So it came down to this heavy debate in front of thousands of monks. The guy said, well, what are you? I'm the Buddha. You're the Buddha. He said, yeah, I am the Buddha. Okay, I am the Buddha. He said, no, you're not, because you have a war on your chin.
He pulls out a box of acne warts.
Okay, anyway. He has satisfied both the needs. The last thing is, this is an interesting point. I mean, he has satisfied his own needs, and he has satisfied our needs.
I'm on 7. Where are you?
Almost
7.
Own and 8 is the others.
4, 5, 6.
Oh,
the two needs. Satisfy the two needs.
Yeah, you're right.
Who's
seven.
The one? Buddha's the one. Is that anything?
No, it's not. It's not 8. It's not one of them.
No, you have two needs.
Yours yeah, there's two needs.
So that's 8.
Yeah,
7 and 8.
Yours and others. Right?
Last time you asked a question that said...
Yeah, and I'm still asking that question. I like you wrote it down. Sorry. Okay, I'll get to it right now. He has fulfilled his own needs, obviously. He doesn't suffer anymore. He's living in a nice paradise. His body is like a rainbow. It's a diamond. He has no suffering. He's very happy. As happy as anyone could ever be. But how, by becoming a Buddha, has he fulfilled my needs? And then the text says, well, there's a big debate about it. And people say, well, I'm still suffering, so he didn't fulfill my needs. And then, or for example, when they talk about the perfection of giving, they say, how can the Buddha have perfected giving if there's still poor people around? So he didn't perfect giving. There's still poor people around. No, the point is, in this case, that he has satisfied our needs and that he is totally available and capable to teach us.
We just have to take refuge.
We don't have the virtue to have it happen.
Well, before you even have that, you have to have the refuge. You have to take the refuge, right?
Yeah, so he has fulfilled our needs. We haven't taken advantage.
Other people wouldn't want to take refuge in a Buddha if you paid him like that. So what's the Buddha going to do? Excuse me, I'm going to give you this anyway, you know?
Fulfilled is a funny verb there.
It's meant to be there. It's Shenden Pinsol. Pinsol, that's Ernst his monk's name. And Anila loves to make fun of him for it. But it means totally, totally fulfilled, totally complete, taken care of, finished, perfect, finito, you know. And so it's very controversial, you know. How can he have fulfilled my needs if I'm still here? He has. So it's a tricky verb, and then we debate about it for weeks. You know, that word.
May I ask if you personally are comfortable with that? It's totally comprehensible, or it's one of the. Other
I mean, the deeper you get into Buddhism, the more you see how everything fits perfectly together. Mm-hmm. And at first there are things that seem contradictory, and that's okay. It's okay. It will, and to say it's not or to pretend it's not is a kind of, it's not acceptable in Buddhism. You have to question it. Okay.
But Michael, why doesn't the Buddha appear to us? This way it's easier for us.
You're not ready. You don't have the goodness for him to appear to you. It's a good karma to have him appear to you. To have the Dalai Lama appear to you is an incredible good karma. To go to Arizona and hear him talk for 5 days was some kind of incredible goodness that we collected to be there.
Yeah. But it was really $200 you had to get, really, too.
That was part of the karma, too. Okay, why take refuge? And then we'll stop. We're doing pretty good. He says that temporal purpose is that they can provide you the highest form of protection. The ultimate purpose is to attain enlightenment. And that short-term purpose is that there is no better protection in this life. You know, if you're worried about some danger in this life, you know, not even talking big time, go for refuge. Take refuge. It can help you. It is the only thing that will help. For example, to do Tonglen, you know, to do this practice of taking on other people's sufferings, or pretending that you could, or fantasizing that you could, is really the best protection against that kind of suffering. It's actually a very powerful cause not to have that kind of suffering yourself. To have a true desire that other people not have it, or that you could take it from other people onto yourself, is actually one of the sweetest protections against it. That's the kind of refuge.
Michael, when you think about without doing the tumbling, right? I was thinking about how you can apply it every day, and you see somebody suffering, and you say, well, I wish that I had this on myself this way. I don't see this person suffering. Right. And what happened at one point, I realized, and suddenly, you know, I was thinking all those things, and then I said, my goodness, I'm going to be all sick. I'm not going to be able to help anybody.
Not like that.
Not like that. No. I figured that was the wrong way.
Sorry. Yeah, no, not like that. Not like that. So that's it. Temporarily, I mean, of all the protections in the world, this is the best protection. If you get protection from some other source, let's say a policeman, if you're in trouble, or a judge, if you have a court case, or a doctor, if you're sick, the reason you are getting help from them has nothing to do with them, right? It's because of something you did. You treated other people, you gave other people medicine, you helped other people. That's why the doctor is effective for you. There's this thing in Buddhism about you go to different countries and the same medicine will have different effects on different people in different countries. And you can see it in India. You know, you can give the same medicine to somebody. There's whole countries where medicine is not as effective to the same population. It's a karma of the medicine. If there's anything about medicine that helps you, if there's any reason a policeman happens to be around when you're being mugged, if there's any reason you win a court case, it has nothing to do with the judge or the policeman or the doctor. It's your own goodness. So taking refuge is the ultimate protection. Taking refuge in your own knowledge of karma, for example, being moral, is the ultimate protection. It's very interesting. Giving is the ultimate poverty solution. You know? It's very interesting. It's very... very interesting, and it works. Try it. I mean, in the tantric texts, I can tell you, Changya Rupa Dorje says...
Should you impoverish yourself, though? That's
do it in the... You can't. Try it. You know? Pick a big object. I mean, pick something holy. And you will not be poor. The Buddha makes a vow. When he became a Buddha, he said, if anybody who tries to follow morality doesn't get fed, you know, let me not be Buddha. Then Buddhahood is a big lie. You know, try it. You'll find that it works. And it's actually the basis for all the higher, for the secret teachings. You know, that idea is very important. And it just works. And that's the cause of things. It's not anything else.
You mean ultimately? I mean, there's still some connection between getting out of bed and going to work and getting that paycheck. I mean, you know, you don't get it if you stay in bed.
Some people do.
Yes, but that's not
What's the long term? I want to do one more short term. One more short term is you can take vows. All the vows. There's three kinds of vows you can take. One are the what we call the freedom vows, which are monk's vows, or the lifetime vows for lay people, which I hope you will all take someday. And I think we'll take that, we'll work on that. You know, we'll talk about it. We'll study the whole thing so that you know what you're doing, which is very nice.
sometimes.
We'll go through that. There's seven lifetime vows. There's one-day vow. You can take the one-day vow anytime. We can take it together sometime. And then there's seven lifetime vows, and two of those can be taken. Yeah, the first three can be taken by... The first three vows, meaning the one-day vow and two layman vows, can be taken by people who still are living not as a monk or a nun. You can take those vows for the rest of your life. You don't have to shave your head or wear robes or give up family life. And they're very nice to take. You should take them. So those are the first kind of vows. The second kind of vows are bodhisattva vows.
Freedom vows, monk's vows?
Monk's vows are one of the eight kinds of freedom vows. The freedom vows are vowed morality, basically.
And the lifetime vows are also part of freedom vows?
There's two kinds of freedom vows. There's eight types of freedom vows. Yene genyen pama nangeja pama gelama gelama na gelama de sosu tabi rin gito. Eight of them.
And vows for lay people at seven total?
No. The first three of the eight can be taken by lay people. The last five can only be taken by people who leave. But they all constitute what we call freedom vows.
I see. Thank you very much.
All eight. And you have to take those sometime. The next level of vows up are bodhisattva vows. Dr. Shin and Chino Mideshi, Shakyamin and Tejo, Goja Koto Chikun, Samagavala, etc. You know, Tundu. And then the secret vows are the third level of vows. And each one is higher than the one below it. To take any of those vows, you must take refuge. As I just said, for a monk, if I try to take monk's vows without the intention of trying to get out of suffering, they don't stick. They don't grow. And it's even more true for the higher vows.
When you say you don't get the vows, that also mean you don't get any of the benefits?
You get, of course, it's much smaller, and you're trying to keep it and everything. Yeah. But it's not, it doesn't have, there's six effects that vows have. And it doesn't have that effect. Obviously, to keep your morality, even if you don't have a vow for it, is great. But you won't, you can't have a vow take its true effect if you don't have renunciation. If you're taking it for any other reason, it won't have its true effect. If you're taking it because everyone else around you is taking it, or you're taking it because somebody said you should take it, or you're taking it because you look smart, or you're taking it because it seems nice, or if you don't take it to get out of suffering, it doesn't have its full effect. So what they say is that one of the benefits of going for refuge is that you can take vows. And if you don't go for refuge, the vow is not going to... Either it won't stick or it won't be very...
Michael,
meaningful.
You said that there's order... Which one's the highest, I would say, is the secret vows?
Yeah.
And then that's the highest. And then the next highest, bodhisattva?
Yeah.
And then freedom vows?
Yeah. And most of us haven't gotten to the freedom vows. And most of us haven't gotten to the little person's
refuge.
We're not Buddhists, hey. We're just talking about it.
It's
kick the ball around.
As you get older, you will appreciate it. You'll see the truth of it. You know, I mean, to really be practicing Dharma, it has to be largely motivated by death. As you get closer, you'll see that. And it's sweet to have it ready in your hand, even though you didn't appreciate it fully. When the time comes, you've already got it ready. That's very useful. Okay, the ultimate benefit is obvious. You can reach Buddhahood. If you don't keep vows, if you don't do what bodhisattvas do, and specifically if you don't take and keep the secret vows, you can't achieve Buddhahood in this
life. Straight to hell.
Yes, I'm memorizing a book now. What is that?
I'm sorry, would you say
that...
I didn't get that.
It took the Buddha like 75,000 kalpas to collect. That was his, the first period of his collection of them. Then the next one was 76,000 kalpas, and the next one was 76,000. I mean, you can do it in one life if you
do. I want a consultation with somebody who can tell me how
many... If you take refuge, then you can take the secret vows. And if you take the secret vows... You can, and if you keep them, you can reach Buddhahood in this way.
And that's so the secret vows are tantra vows.
Yeah. Tantra means secret.
So if we did the Kala Chakra initiation, I think we took secret vows, but of course I personally didn't know what I was doing. So
yeah, that's why.
It's the seed, isn't it?
You could have the vows, but they could be decimated by now. You know what I mean? I mean, no, my monk's vows are similar, you know. I'm just finding out after 10 years. I'm studying them in deep detail. And if we have broken them, then they are injured forever. You know, they are, like, damaged. And I'm very sad to learn that I've done some of them and I didn't
Why
know the details.
Why are they injured forever? I thought everything could be made.
They take a big hit, you know. Seriously, that's how it's described. And if you don't hide it, if you openly confess to your abbot or an older monk, or in your case, your lama or whatever, you can restore it a lot. The word is called chirchuga or sojong. You can restore it pretty well, but it'll never be like it was before you broke it the first, before you damaged it.
It's still damaged. Giving you vows.
You don't lose the vows. To lose a freedom vow, you have to die or give it back. There's three other ways you can do it, but you probably won't do it. You could change your sex three times. And there's some other ones like that.
Only in New York.
By the way, I should mention one more, which is called Getsache. You can do that. Getsache is to give up Buddhism. So this is all bullshit. You know, karma is bullshit. This is all meaningless, you know. That thought makes you lose your vows. But aside from that, luckily, you can have them decimated and you can still keep them.
So then you have the idea.
But the way they give you the vows without giving you, like, the guidebook
very,
for,
very
like,
improper.
You know.
Yeah, it's generally...
They'll give anyone vows
at
any initiation, and they'll give you monks and nuns vows, apparently, without you knowing what they are.
No, you have to... Ideally, you should study them deeply.
Because they'll tell you what they are.
No, the purpose of a class like this, we'll go through that. We'll do those. We'll go through them. We'll do them in detail. Tsongkhapa, the first book in Tsongkhapa's collected works, is a huge book on those three vows. It's very detailed.
It's also, the whole thing is an accumulative process as well. I doubt if you would find many Buddhas who, you know, at one point in their career, they finally took vows, and it was perfectly, you know,
they kept them
kept the whole time. I think it happens over and over again to everyone.
Oh no, it's you, but you have to have the intention to keep them. I mean, you have to take them knowing what they are and with the true intent to keep them pure.
And then sometime at a very mature point in someone's career, they'll be born somewhere, they'll take vows, and they'll have kept them really nicely the whole time, and everyone will say, wow, you know. And it's like, yeah, sure, after 10 million lifetimes of breaking or
something. Yeah, but
you have to stop now. The dog is barking. That's a sign.
The motivation of taking a vow has to involve... By the way, the vows also do not form if in the back of your mind you think, well, they all sound pretty good except that one, you know? And
what about drinking beer?
That one is a little... I can probably just keep most of them and then I'll be all right. That motivation prevents the vow from forming, as far as Vinaya vows.
What about also the idea of, well, I'll try them, and if it doesn't work, then I'll just, you know,
No, it's a yeah. That's also it won't sure. form properly yeah. because it's a lifetime vow.
That's what you do for one day.
It's a yeah. The, no, the one day vow will work. But yeah, someone was telling me, oh, my friend said I could become a monk for 3 years, and no.
You do that in the Hinayana tradition.
There's a custom in Burma, Thailand, to, in fact, it's a government. You get a government pension for the period. You can leave work for 3 months, and your employer is required to let you go. And you can become a monk for like 3 months and then come back.
Every year? Or
no, like once in your life. You're supposed to be, what, age 20 or something? Or?
Yeah, 21.
Yeah, 21.
It's like compulsory.
I thought you could do
it's not compulsory, but a lot of people do it. And it's interesting, the effect in Thailand is if you can meet a bellboy or you can meet a taxi driver, which I have met, and they'll start explaining Vipassana to you. And I like, that's a nice thing. But technically, it's not in the, it's not in the Vinaya. Technically, there's 7 lifetime vows, and there's 1 day vow, and there ain't nothing else in any tradition of the original Vinaya. So that's a custom, and it's a good custom. I think it's a helpful custom. I think it makes all the men I've met in Thailand, and many of the men had a good knowledge of Buddhism from that. The king himself did that, right?
I'm not sure.
No, he did. It's very nice. Yeah, so that's a nice thing. Like if George Bush had
done that. People want to have to meditate in the cave for 3 years before they can run for president. No one would want to do it.
You can't give up your vows and then take them back.
You can.
You can.
A monk can. It's technically possible, but it's very extraordinary and not. If you take a vow with the intention of giving it back and later taking it again, it won't form.
No, not with the intention, but at some point, then you give it, and then you can take it back.
Properly give it back, mm-hmm. but at which time you have lied, because you swore to keep it for your life.
But at the time you swore, you meant
to. No, I know.
I mean, you had the intention to, yeah. So it's not a lie.
Oh, sure. You swear. You say, I will keep this for my life. You have to swear, or else you don't get the vow.
So it's a partial karma you collect.
So it's very undesirable. Technically, it's possible.
So we blow our vows for, let's say those of us who took the Kali Chakra
that's
vow, and we didn't even know what we were doing, right? Yeah.
Which is a higher vow.
Which is a higher vow than a monk's vow.
No, but the technicalities of the secret vows are a little bit different.
Okay, we didn't know what we were doing, so we've already blown them, because we didn't even know what we were doing. Should we bother to even attempt to do the practice?
Obviously, yes. Of course you should. And then you should try.
Try.
One more thing. Taking vows, you can restore by taking the initiative.
Is it the same? They take the big hit and they're not as strong? Is it the same idea?
No.
It's not?
You can take them again and they're pure.
Oh.
As I understand it, but I can't talk about it here. And luckily, because I don't know much about it.
Same with the Bodhisattva.
Yeah.
Same with the Bodhisattva.
Etc.
You can take them over there.
I mean, you get the same sort of crippling effect of breaking.
I don't know that technically.
It doesn't sound like. Depends on whether they're secondary downfalls or root downfalls. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't believe you don't lose them the way that a monk does.
Uki su chi me ta tra Vi ra vlin chi ni de jen pa gi Sangye shim du mi te u wa gi Krokun nam dak shim ta tu pa shu Iram guru ra na mandala kam nir yata yam
Homework.
Oh, we almost made it.